Good evening and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Joining me as tonight's co-host, courtesy of the San Jose office of Berliner Cohen, Josh Borger, by now well-known, it should be well-known to all of you as a frequent guest on Your Legal Rights and a co-host, practices commercial and civil litigation in a variety of areas.
Thank you, Jeff. You've heard a little about a future with robots and self-driving cars, and it may be closer than you think. The issue tonight is whether the law is prepared to deal with it.
Tonight, join us as we look at artificial intelligence and the legal framework surrounding it.
Our guests are at the cutting edge of a wholly new world that is emerging upon us, where artificial intelligence is meant to serve us, and then where do we go if one of these issues goes wrong?
And that could be a machine or it could be something built into stuff you're already using. As always, we're eager to hear what's on your mind and to answer your questions. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're not in the Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. As always, our attorney guests can't give you specific legal advice, as we don't have all the salient facts of your case, but we're happy to share the legal principles to help guide you in your decision-making. And you can contact us with any question about the law surrounding emerging technologies and artificial intelligence, whether it's machine, whether it's software, something that does the thinking for you, or whether it's something that bakes your bread for you. Any of the question about artificial intelligence, you're not limited at the point we may be in our conversation.
Help us sort out just what's going on here. We have first from Reed Smith, LLP, Craig Lilly, a leading legal advisor for strategies and private equity clients on domestic and cross-border technology acquisitions. Craig advises emerging technology companies.
And Mark Lyon is chair of the Artificial Intelligence and Automated Systems Practice Group at Gibson Dunn, bringing nearly three decades of experience as a trial lawyer and trusted corporate legal advisor to companies in a wide range of technology areas. He has extensive experience representing and advising clients on the legal, ethical, regulatory, and policy issues arising from emerging technologies such as artificial intelligence. So with that, Mark, Craig, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm glad to join you.
You know, before we get too far, I have to ask you guys, the fundamental question, what is artificial intelligence?
Craig, I'll take a stab and then Craig, you should give your spin on it too. I think the key thing to keep in mind is there isn't a thing called artificial intelligence. It's actually a whole plethora of different kinds of technologies. The key aspects to my mind and the way I think of it is that we're allowing machines and really computers to do things, make decisions, make recommendations, take actions that have typically been done by humans. And now we're letting the machines do those kinds of things because they have the capabilities to potentially make decisions that prior machines may not have made or may not have made well. So that's my take on what it is.
Yeah, my take is artificial intelligence basically is the ability to learn, reason, and problem solve and develop perceptions based on, you know, data sets. And algorithms obviously achieve that. But basically, that's in a nutshell what artificial intelligence is.
So one of the things that I noticed is how modern kitchens are inching their way to look like something we saw in the Jetsons, where we have refrigerators that know what you put in there and when, and probably what it looks like. And they'll alert you if you got to use something pretty quickly, and they'll even pull recipes off the internet for you and point it in your direction and maybe ask you if you wanted to operate the stove. Is that really where all this is going? I mean, things that we're used to operating are suddenly going to be doing the work for us?
Yeah, to some degree, I think what we're seeing, and you're very right to point that out, because all these smart appliances, smart light bulbs, smart, you know, doorbell, smart everything that we've got nowadays. Some of it is very subtle, and a lot of what we see, which is machine learning or artificial intelligence, has to do with things like power management and various things that might help it work better. The moment a refrigerator tells me I shouldn't be going after that snack that I want at midnight because it's, you know, not good for me, that's when I think we've gone too far. But, you know, but beyond that, you know, there's a lot of capabilities that potentially can be built into these things based on patterns, you know, patterns of behavior and patterns that they're seeing, that they might be able to tell you, you seem to be low on butter, for example. And that is some of these refrigerators now, I think, are trying to do those kinds of tasks.
And the one that actually we might see the most around, that gets most press, given where we are, is the self-driving cars. So question for you, if something goes awry, since now my car apparently doesn't even need me, and an accident happens, is it possible, if there was a malfunction in the car or in the program, who's liable for that? Am I liable? Is the person who programmed it? Is the manufacturer? How does this differ from a standard accident? Who gets sued in this?
Well, let me take again, I'll just jump in, but Craig, feel free to jump in on these two. I don't want to hog the whole discussion, because this is a really interesting area. With respect to cars, it's very complicated, because, you know, it depends on what the problem is to a large degree. It's kind of like, you know, if it was a problem of the sensors or a problem of the programming, that could be something that kind of falls along the lines of traditional products liability issues, where is this a defect, or is this a, you know, is it a design defect, a manufacturing defect? Are there things like that? It can also be attributed to other things. It may be something about the way it's being operated, or way the users have programmed it to operate under certain conditions. That may be something, you know, it's not necessarily a manufacturer that's at fault. But it is, and there's also, of course, you know, just the normal negligence issues, where it might be another driver that's really at fault for the accident. Might not, frankly, a lot of these cases where we see accidents with autonomous vehicles, it's because they've been rear-ended by somebody who didn't expect them to actually follow the traffic regulations and stop at a stop sign instead of just kind of rolling through it or something like that. So, you know, there are a lot of different factors that fall into who should be liable for those kinds of things.
Yeah, that's right. I guess the first question is, was it operated correctly? And secondly, obviously you can look at everyone in the chain of all the who's developing the software, and you know, were there malfunctions in that? Was there malfunctions in the manufacturer? Everyone who's actually touched the automation of the car could theoretically be liable for that. And then obviously, as Mark pointed out, you know, the other driver. So you've got, you know, comparative negligence type issues as well.
So what used to be a simple lawsuit between the two people in the accident, now because of automatic cars, is going to be the person who claims they're injured and about 50 defendants for every single simple rear-end collision, potentially.
Potentially, although the interesting thing about autonomous vehicles is they collect so much information. They have so many sensors that are recording information all the time, terabytes and petabytes of information, that when you actually look at what happened, there's actually a pretty good record of what the circumstances were and what was going on at the time. So you can get a pretty good picture of what happened, unlike a normal car, where unless you have an eyewitness or something, you may not really know. So there is a certain amount of that, while yes, there may be a lot of defendants, at the same time, we may be able to figure out pretty quickly what happened and who should be responsible.
That's right. Most of these cars are obviously collecting data and also have video of what's happened as well.
You know, I'm going to make a little jump. I kind of got us started when I was asking about machines that were used to running, and now they're starting to get closer and closer to making their own decisions and running themselves. But what about things that we think of as getting closer and closer to human already? Like look at the robots that are in use, whether it's in factories or perhaps more so in homes as time goes on. As the technology develops, it seems like they're getting closer and closer to thinking like us. I guess the real question I have is, you know, we've seen where courts have granted rights to things other than human. They give property rights to other primates and the like for things that they might have developed. Is there some likelihood that at some point down the road they're going to do the same with this artificial intelligence and maybe they start getting rights?
So that's a pretty tricky – it's an interesting question because it's very – you know, it gets really philosophical very quickly, and it's kind of a slippery slope as to, you know, where do you start drawing lines as to who should legally be a person or what should legally be a person. There are corporations, for example, that are legal persons under the law. They're even though they're not thinking, they're not intelligent by themselves, and they only act through people. But corporations are obviously – some one entity that's not human that is a person under the law. Most of the courts and most of the legislatures that have looked at these kinds of questions and regulators tend to think that we're not at a point where machines should be considered a person at this point. They're pretty far away from it, any more than a computer 10 years ago before we got into artificial intelligence should have been a person just because it was executing a program that somebody else programmed into it. But there are some pushes to do that, particularly because in some areas it gets hard to figure out how to allocate liability amongst parties. And one example of that is intent. If you have a situation where you require intent for there to be liability or in a crime or something like that, it's not likely that you're going to be able to prove that a machine had some kind of a corrupt intent. It had the intent to make an action, perhaps, and that may be enough to get you through the law. But if you require some kind of malicious intent, that's where it may be a situation where machines may not fall into that very easily. And do we need to adjust the laws or do we need to adjust how we view the situation?
Yeah, I think fundamentally, from a theoretical standpoint, I think really it depends with if technology or AI can develop a conscience where it can determine right and wrong, be able to differentiate that and make decisions. And as we move closer to that, those will impart duties and obligations on the artificial intelligence. And in relating to that, they'll develop rights. So at this point, you know, I think when it has those ability to make decisions like that, then it'll impose both rights, but also obligations and duties.
Occasionally we get a call from a listener who doesn't want to be on the air, but passes on a question. And this one, actually, I thought it was a very good question at that. They're asking about robots that are at work in hospitals. Mm-hmm. Who do you sue for malpractice?
So, and let's step back for a second too, because robot's kind of a loaded word too. We think when we hear robot, we kind of think of C-3PO and we think of some kind of physical robot, which you know, in a lot of cases, that's what we're talking about. But there are a huge number of what I think of as robots that are actually just software programs, sometimes referred to as bots, sometimes as other things, chatbots, for example. And so all of that is definitely throughout all of industry. There are lots and lots and lots of software-based robot programs that are out in industry operating now, in healthcare being one of them. Generally, at this point, I would say that the view of the courts right now is that products liability laws seem to be pretty well suited to being able to handle accidents that come up where some kind of a bot or an AI is involved, because usually there's going to be doctors involved. There's people that are also supervising this. It's not a situation where you have just some rogue machine that is going off and doing something. It's being guided or governed by other people that have responsibilities and can be held accountable for some of what's being done. But you know, there are going to be circumstances where that may not be the case, and we may have to revisit laws as things get more complicated and these things get more ingrained.
Right. I think it's really similar to how cars are handled. First, you look at the operator. Were they using it the way it was intended? And were they within the parameters of the guidelines and how they used it? And then you can delve down into whether it's a software programs, whether there are errors in programming. Obviously, the software programs have algorithms where they develop over time as well. And so you can look through the chain of the operator and also the program or the robot, the hospitals, insurance companies. It really depends on the facts and circumstances of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Let me switch gears a little bit. You mentioned earlier that artificial intelligence, as we know, is constantly collecting data. There seem to be privacy implications about that. They're collecting things based on our preferences. It could be on our location. Who owns this data? What rights and responsibilities are there as far as who can get this data? Who owns the data?
So that is that we could spend this program and many more talking about those kinds of issues. That's it's a really very interesting issue to me anyway. You see a lot of activity in the regulations in Europe and in the United States and in legislation in California and other places trying to get some of these data privacy rights in place. The the California Consumer Privacy Act that was enacted and went into effect a couple of years ago. And now we have the California CPRA. I'm forgetting the acronym now, but the new one that passed with the this last election that's going to go into effect in a couple of years. And, you know, those are both geared towards giving people who have data some ability to say, don't use my data or don't sell it, or I want to opt out from your ability to use this data. And that's not something that's been in the United States much before. Europe has been more of a front leader on trying to make sure that people have rights in their own data. But it's a really complicated question because there are a lot of times where you may not have a lot of control about your data because you've already put it out there on the internet and you may have lost control over some of it and people can do what they want with it. In other cases, you may have the ability to have some rights and be able to say, I don't want you to make decisions about me with a machine.
Right. And also there's questions about making the data more generalized. So it's de-identified. That's a big issue too. And then of course, when you go into data, data could be corrupted. It could be manipulated. It could be subject to bias inherently. And even algorithms within that data can create biases or be manipulated as well.
We were talking a little bit about that before going on the air, about some of those biases and how they could be transferred. One of the issues that came up, and I realize I'm jumping way ahead from where we were, but where we were heading, but one of the issues that came up was in the last election when there was an issue about whether we should get rid of cash bail. And the opposition to the proposition came up with the idea of using an algorithm, which is really what this legislature had authored. Can you talk a little bit about algorithms and how they could develop a bias both on the data being put in it, but also maybe on the software side? Can you tell us a little bit about that? That could be a whole show also, I think.
Sure. There's a number of ways where a bias, an unintentional bias, can get put into a system. You can basically, the way these things work in general is that they take a large amount of data and they process that data with some algorithms that they have built into them that then looks, essentially it's looking for patterns in the data and kind of drawing inferences and trying to be able to come up with things that it can use to make decisions. And so one way that a bias can get put in is the data that you can input to these systems as you're training them to make sure they understand what they should be doing. That data itself could be biased. It could be skewed heavily towards or against one group or another. And that can build in a bias into the decision system itself. Sometimes unknown patterns in the data, and just this can be biases that are in our society as a whole that we may all, some of which we can try to pull out, but some of which may be hidden in the data that we don't realize. They may pull out patterns in that data that may create biases. They may learn biases over time as they realize certain decisions seem to work better than others, but that may be based on factors that we don't want them to be making decisions on. So there's a lot of different ways bias can kind of work its way into a system if we're not careful.
Yeah, definitely. And bias can be developed by, you know, geographic location or by interests as well. We talked before this about like sentencing guidelines. A lot of sentencing guidelines use algorithms. And at least in one case, you know, the Wisconsin Supreme Court determined that didn't violate the defendant's due process rights, even though the defense didn't know about that. Neither did the court, actually. But I think they're already using, in a lot of states, algorithms right now in sentencing guidelines.
Let me turn it over to Mark in San Francisco. Mark, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. I have a question. Let's say, for example, a car that's driving itself has a decision to make. A pedestrian suddenly jumps into the road, and the car has a choice between hitting the pedestrian or hitting a tree and endangering the people inside the car, for example. What are the legal issues there?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's called the classic trolley car problem. It's sort of, you know, the trolley car is going to run over somebody. Does it jump the tracks and endanger the people inside, or does it just run over the individual and save the people inside? It's very difficult to decide which way to go and what you should do ahead of time. It's ultimately going to depend on a couple of things. Is there a decision that's built into the vehicle as to how to handle that? And if so, what are the factors that's making that decision, and why should it be making that? That may be something that's been sort of decided ahead of time. If that's the case, there may be some liability there if we believe that was the wrong choice to be made. But the reality is most systems aren't going to be like that. Most of the AVs aren't going to have something pre-wired. They're going to try to do the best that they can to avoid harm to everybody. And the question will then be, how good is the algorithm? How accurate was the data that they have? You know, were there things that could have been avoided? Was everything done reasonably? And so it gets to be very, you know, it's going to be a difficult situation, but at its heart, it's not a lot different than what a human would face if they were in the car and they actually had the same decision. You know, what should they have done in that situation? Were they acting reasonably as well?
Yeah, it's my understanding right now that algorithms don't make those decisions. And I think that's actually something for, you know, policy and for legal, people and courts and, Congress and regulatory people make those decisions as to what those should be. But, you know, as of right now, it's my understanding that they don't make those decisions in those algorithms for autonomous vehicles.
Well, let's go back to what you were referencing before about how they can or cannot be used in court. Can you bring in evidence that someone had a propensity to commit a crime, to rape someone, whether it could be used in a civil or a criminal proceeding? And then what would that propensity be based on? Would it be based on biased factors?
So, yeah, that's a very difficult. I mean, generally, propensities are something that are kind of disfavored, I think, as evidentiary. So it's something that's hard to get into a court generally as well. But obviously, some of these algorithms can try to draw patterns. I think we were talking before the show a little bit about the show or the movie Minority Report, where they tried to actually take that one step further and arrest people before they even committed a crime based on some of these things. We're not there yet by any means, but. There are programs out there. There's a program called Compass, for example, that got a lot of press a few years ago and has been the subject of lawsuits, where they were trying to predict recidivism in people who were being paroled and trying to predict it from a lot of different data points. And what is the risk that this person's going to go out and commit another crime? Should they be paroled? And they were given sort of a rating, if you will, that then was then used by the judge to help decide parole. That has problems. I mean, there are at least allegedly had problems. I have not studied it myself, but when you read the articles, there's certainly some analysis out there that indicated it had problems with respect to the built-in bias of the data sets, because there was just a skew against people of color, African Americans in particular, I believe, that had to do with, you know, the data sets that were being used as part of it. And so there was a number of lawsuits and articles and pushes to avoid that being used. And so I think people are having to approach it pretty carefully right now. There are programs in use, but I think they're all being used as carefully as they can be to try to use it and be thinking about it with recommendations, because there are these dangers built into them.
Yeah, and already companies now, you know, large, you know, tech companies already know that there's inherently bias in their programming, and they're trying to, you know, come up with ways to, you know, deal with that. Because obviously the data itself could be biased. And also you got each data scientist or programmer who's programming, that could also influence the bias of any particular program that they're developing.
Well, it sounds like implicit in what you're saying is that perhaps the algorithms and programs that are out now don't necessarily filter what comes in quite the way we do. So they may be much more accurate and faster at processing large amounts of data, but they don't necessarily filter either that data itself or the results it takes them to in the same way that we do. But that would beg the question, shouldn't there be somebody operating it that could be that filter, that could oversee it and say, wait, that doesn't look right to me?
Right. And I think that's a lot of what, you know, using these things as recommendations and having somebody who understands the program and its limitations to be able to reflect and have a human perspective on it is still, I think, the preferred way of doing things in a lot of cases. But, you know, there are ways to build in guardrails, if you will, and to make sure that these programs don't overemphasize some particular characteristic that we don't want them to do. And there are ways to do that. And there are certainly a lot of work in the field these days to try to find ways to eliminate or prevent unwanted bias and disparate impact from happening in some of these programs.
We're led to believe that computers, humans are biased. When you have computers, it's going to take out the bias. And you're letting us know that's not necessarily true. As computers, as artificial intelligence deals with a lot of these issues instead of humans, if it does have that bias because of it was input or because it sees patterns, are there going to be certain groups or populations that we think are going to be disadvantaged by this, more so than if it was just done by humans?
So that's a hard question to ask or to answer in the abstract, because it really depends on the situation. I think, you know, definitely it is a concern. It's a concern in healthcare, where you have situations where you may be allocating resources from hospital to hospital. And because there may not be a demand for something does not mean you don't want to have that service still available to people in that area. And so there are different, you know, it goes from everything from logistics to mortgage applications, to banking, to, you know, all these different things where it might be used, that you have to be careful that whatever systems you have in place, somebody's watching over them to make sure there isn't an unwanted impact like that.
So we've been talking a little bit about philosophy and a little bit about bias and a little bit about how this might, the application of some of these artificial intelligences might not filter data in the same way as people would. And it seems that a lot of the specific applications that we've been talking about really are an application of that area. And I expect to do that when we come back. We do have Alan from Berkeley on the line. Alan, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yeah, so my question is somewhat arcane, but very much related to what you're talking about. So the most effective tool for AI predictive analysis today is neural networks. And neural networks generally work by having a set of algorithms inside of them. And the one that's the most efficacious, that works the best, is the one that's performance is used. The challenge with that is that you can't really predict which biases it's going to have and how effective it's going to be. And the other side of the challenge is that your data set is only as good as the constant data you have at the time, whereas in a situation like the kinds you're talking about, you're going to be looking at very complex situations with multivariate analysis needed. So there are a lot of different issues that you haven't touched on that relate to how complex this data is handled. Typically on Wall Street, the way it's done is you run very complex algorithms, but you have a human being always validating your data, because otherwise you run into something called black swans, where you have basically the perfect storm hit once in every 10, 15 years and completely wipe you out. And that has happened repeatedly. Point being that data algorithm set validation is not the best solution, and the ones that work best confound the process of proving its lack of bias.
Before anybody jumps in to respond to that, we do need to take a real quick break. Alan, you're welcome to stay on the line. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
And we're back. Was everyone able to follow what Alan was saying?
Yeah, no, I understand. And Alan's right that it's a difficult question as far as having just a machine do it, which is why I think you see a lot of situations these days where there aren't very many situations where machines are calling all the shots. In fact, I can't really think of any situations where that's the case, where there isn't human oversight in some way, shape, or form, both through the training process and all the way through into the actual operation itself. And that's just because these things are very capable, but they're very narrow in what they can do for the most part. That's changing, and there's some work going on these days to expand the ability of these things of AI systems to be able to learn and do different things. But right now they're sort of very, very, very narrow focus and good at what they do. But it is a challenge. There are tools to help you in designing and developing. There are a lot of different ways to test for and to try to eliminate bias ahead of time, which is what is done. But it is a continual battle. It's not something I would say you can sort of put it out there and then forget about it, particularly if these things are going to continue to learn and continue to evolve over time. They need to be monitored.
Yeah, I think an evolving area, years from now, there could be like a chief AI officer who monitors all this and makes all the decisions. You know, for example, on Wall Street, I guess the big fear and also the reason why they have the circuit breakers, if you have all these programmed traders that are basically operating on the same information, coming up with the same decision, and so they're doing the same thing. So I guess there's challenges and concerns over that as well.
We have a lot of clients who have exactly that. They've instituted, you know, a data science office, a chief AI officer, you know, even not just in the technology side, but also in the legal department. So I think that is something that's really happening.
I did get another caller that wrote in asking if an autonomous vehicle can be used as a witness in a crime or a civil tort if it wasn't directly involved, but its video perhaps captured things, and asked if this is considered evidence, whether the video is or the data it may have collected.
Yeah, I don't see why not. I mean, it's sort of like video you see from somebody's, their home security camera. You have video that's used like that all the time. It has to go through certain tests and authentication and to make sure that it's got some validity to it, but certainly I could see that being an issue down the road in some cases.
Yeah, I mean, it's subject to the same type issues you have of any evidence. It's got to be authenticated. It has to be verified that it wasn't corrupted or manipulated in any way, but it definitely could be used.
Somebody has to be able to establish that it came out of this car from this point in time. And I've had two cases recently, each involving a Tesla, one having an automobile break-in, one actually breaking into a building, and both times a Tesla that was parked there. One of them may have been the subject of that break-in, but the other one was merely parked right there, and they record everything.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing how much data autonomous vehicles actually collect from time. So just depending on, you know, what's being collected at the time and what's available, you could definitely see some issues where that may be a situation down the road. A lot of it's still new, so I think courts are going to be a little skeptical at first, but as we get more used to it, I think it's more likely to see the light of day.
So I could see where this could also be problematic in the employment setting. It's my understanding that, for example, a person may get, an employer may get 1,000 applicants or so for a job, and you may have some form of artificial intelligence narrow down the ones that this person may actually want to look at or interview. But if there's biased input, or if it's not biased input, but the machine, as we've said, the artificial intelligence has detected certain patterns, you could have biased output. They could be taking out people from certain communities. I could see this having implications dealing with race or gender or so forth. Is this possible? Has this happened?
There have been complaints about it happening. I think there's been some concerns that this does happen sometimes. It's definitely something that companies who are developing these tools have to take into account, just like you would in the context of mortgage approvals or loan approval, you know, bank account credit approvals, anything like that. You have to be careful on what you're basing the information And I think Craig was mentioned earlier. I mean, you know, it can be things as subtle as just your activities. Maybe, you know, the fact that, you played, a polo or something like that as part of your, you know, as a part of your bringing up would have some bearing on things. You know, things that where maybe some people have access to that others don't, but that doesn't make any difference really as far as what their capabilities are. But that's maybe what the program latches into because it sees a trend in success in some other areas or something. And that can be a problem.
Yeah, I definitely think at the end of the day, that's going to be monitored by a person because, you know, as Mark indicated, you can look at habits and determine, you know, who a person is, whether it's their particular race or, you know, any type of, you know, preferences, whatever that may be, or their gender. So I definitely think it has to be monitored. There's so many ways also that algorithms will adapt over time. And so they'll become smarter and smarter so they can put, you know, two and two together to figure out really who that person is.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me follow up with that. So let's assume for a second that the input was not biased, but because of a pattern that the AI saw, you ended up with a very biased applicant pool and you hired based on that biased applicant pool. Are you aware, and let's say that was based on inadvertently because of that race discrimination, whether and maybe they took people out of certain neighborhoods that tended to be more of this minority versus that minority. Are you aware of any lawsuits throughout the country where this has been the allegation and what has happened in that suit?
So I'm aware that there have been some suits that have been alleging that there have been discrimination on certain basis in some of these hiring as well as mortgage application programs. At the moment, I'm not aware of anywhere they've gone to sort of a decision and have come down. They've either settled out or they are still in the process of going through or they were dismissed for other reasons. But I think, you know, the bottom line to this is just shows you really have to have some kind of an oversight with this. Some of these kinds of, you know, if you look at it after the fact and say, what does my pool look like? You know, I've got all these people coming in. What does it look like coming out? And you just monitor that. Sometimes you can actually see very quickly, okay, there seems to be a problem. I'm missing, there's not very much representation from this group or that group. And that's not something I would be expecting. So sometimes it's easy to identify. Other times it may be really subtle and difficult. I can't remember, there was a study a few years back where you only needed about 3 or 4 data points about a person and you could identify exactly who that person was. There was things like zip code, gender, and birth date, I think, or something like that. It's sort of frightening how much information can be pulled out from just very disparate stuff. So we have to be conscious that that's the case and making sure that we're doing what we can to avoid problems like that from cropping up.
Well, prediction. Now, since you said it hasn't gone to the final judgment, give me a prediction. If the employer does everything they can, but because of some pattern, something biased does happen and they see it afterwards that there was bias in that and they get sued, do you think the employer is going to be liable?
I think if it's proved, well, I mean, there are certain, you know, it depends on the category of person we're talking about too. There are protected classes under the law.
That's what I'm asking. If the person is in a protected class and if this is what turned out to happen.
If it is a protected class, I mean, you are going to be held responsible if you're found not to have acted reasonably and if you violated any of the laws that affect that protected class. So I think it's going to be a question of what is reasonable conduct here and what did you do and were you acting reasonably, particularly once it's been demonstrated there is a problem? Have you taken steps to try to make sure that doesn't occur? And how reasonable were you at the beginning of it? So it's hard to say in any particular case, but I wouldn't be surprised if there'll be instances of people being found who have violated laws based on these kinds of things from time to time.
Yeah, I think it'll be difficult for employers, just like lenders, to use software or algorithms or artificial intelligence as a defense. There's multiple ways that we found that, you know, those can lead to biases. So just because you're using a software program to give you information about who to hire, I don't think that alone could be, you know, could be used as a defense. At the end of the day, the company just is a legal entity and it's going to be responsible for those decisions. And ultimately it's people who make the decisions, even though maybe the program, you know, gives a certain result that you should hire X.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Joining me tonight, along with my co-host tonight, Josh Borger, we've been taking a look at the law surrounding the emerging world of artificial intelligence with Craig Lilly from Reed Smith, LLP, and Mark Lyon, chair of the Artificial Intelligence and Automated Systems Practice Group at Gibson Dunn. If you have questions for my guest, and you still have a few minutes if you want questions, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You don't have to jump at the moment that we are in our conversation. You could really jump in about anything in this fascinating topic. And it really has been fascinating. You should make yourselves a part of this conversation. You still have a few minutes. 866-798-8255. We've been talking about things like philosophy and liability. One of the things we didn't bring up is sometimes you're competing with somebody and it's just not a level playing field. It's not fair. And whether it's the law of competition, even something as simple as competing algorithms, or maybe automated stock trading and how some people jump in and traders, normal people like you and I, really can't get a handle on what's going on in the market anymore because there's all these sophisticated programs doing it. Can you talk a little bit about those aspects?
Sure. Some of it can be very challenging. Obviously there are laws against, for example, colluding on pricing and things like that, that if you leave an algorithm to talk with another algorithm, there's been studies where occasionally they too arrive on sort of like a joint agreement on what prices should be, which would be potentially a violation of law in many jurisdictions. So there are things like that that are a problem. In the United States, there's been less activity with respect to those areas other than looking at, I think, at control and some of the stuff that we're seeing today coming out of the FTC and some of the other areas. But in Europe, there's been a fair amount of concern over what's data aggregators and having, companies acquiring other companies that have data pools. And are you taking away data from general use that then gives you too big an advantage in being able to develop systems that can take advantage of that data? And that's something that, Europe has been more aggressive with than the United States so far. And we haven't seen, too many deals killed because of that, but I think we're starting to see people looking at it much more closely.
Right. And there's been examples of private litigants who've made lawsuits against, companies where they used algorithms that, led to unfair competition practices. And there's been a few, Department of Justice, inquiries into companies and also make claims or, negotiate settlements with companies who have used algorithms that have been unfair. I know there's been sellers on Amazon and stuff that have used algorithms in a unfair way where they've been subject to settlements and things with private litigants in that regard as well.
And not only the trading or the selling of things, but using algorithms to gather materials and actually feed it back to people and control what they think, such as we had the Facebook case just a few years ago where it was said that they're allowing a third party to, whether it's to place ads or political commentary or the like, based on algorithms where they figured how they can target their audience and really control public opinion.
Yeah, and we see that, I think that got a lot of news when you can, with respect to elections, for example, and disinformation campaigns and, deep fake video issues where you can create images or video to make things look like they happened that actually didn't or take things out of context. There's a lot of those kinds of concerns that are going out right now where machines are able to help people create these kinds of false impressions and false information. And we have to be careful of it because it's getting harder to find. It's actually taking AIs to find out that an AI created an image sometimes. And that's the world we're living in now. We have an issue where we really have to be vigilant on a lot of these areas.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, at the end of the day, the technology, artificial intelligence, is only as good as the data and the programmer, and AI keeps developing over time to adjust. And so I think it just leads to the conclusion you really need to have a person monitoring, the biases or information as well in the results.
It would seem that artificial intelligence and intellectual property also could go hand in hand. A few shows ago, we were talking about the monkey selfie copyright dispute, where if you remember, a monkey hit a button and took a photo, and PETA sued, claiming that the monkey had rights to that for taking the selfie. We know that artificial intelligence can create music, for example, and other items. So if the artificial intelligence does create music, does it have copyright rights? Is it the author? Is it the inventor? Can it be an artist? What IP rights can it have?
So the AI itself does not have rights under U.S. law and under most other laws, other kinds of IP laws itself. It's just the Naruto case, the one you're talking about, the monkey selfie case, is a good example of that. You can't have a copyright in a non-person. So, for example, if an AI creates music, the AI doesn't have a copyright in that music. However, the person who's operating that AI or who programmed that AI, who may have dealt with and helped start that, they may have a copyright in that. It depends on how that was all set up. And the same thing goes with patent laws, too. There are, if people are involved and people are, which they usually are, and people are involved in creating and setting up the situation that then creates the whatever song or a work of art or whatever it may be, there very well may be copyrights that or patent rights that go to those kinds of inventions and creations. But there are situations you could see where there may not be a patent. And I actually, I did an article a few years ago on whether or not it would be a good idea to allow patents in some cases, because do we really want machines to be able to spit out thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of patents on different things that really don't take much effort for the machine to come up with? But, you know, the whole idea is to reward people's efforts. Maybe we really don't want to have machines being able to be owning these things. We want people to be the ones that actually have those rights.
Well, I think the big problem, too, is if you say, for example, you gave AI rights to a patent, you know, how do you hold artificial intelligence accountable if there's infringements? How do you hold them liable for violations of law? So, I mean, ultimately, it ends up being whoever the owner of that is. And so I think that's the way it's got to be, at least in the near term.
You know, one last area that comes to mind is you're a company that works with artificial intelligence. Maybe it's not your primary business, but it's something that you've incorporated into your business. It does some of the work and contributes toward your effort. How can you possibly understand and look ahead to all the risks related to your product, whether you're an accounting firm and they use some algorithms to project, or whether it's a technology firm that's developing a self-driving car, whatever it may be? How can you contract to provide really foreseeability for all these issues and where they're going to go?
So it's a great question. Some of what you see in a lot of contracts that we're working with these days, and I think for the foreseeable future are going to be working, is that there's usually a discussion, a negotiation about where do we want the liability to fall? And so there is an effort to set up indemnities and representations and warranties and things like that within the agreements that sort of allocate who's going to take the risk of something happening with this technology. Is there a way it should be performing that we are going to say this is the way it should be? And we'll warrant that it's going to function that way. And how do we define that? Those are the kinds of questions that come up a lot. And to some degree, it can be very difficult because I think one of our callers mentioned neural networks, which are notoriously difficult to figure out exactly how they work. There are a lot of techniques and things being developed to try to do that. But it's difficult for people to understand exactly how a neural network makes all of its decisions after it's been trained.
It looks as though we have one last call coming through. George from San Francisco, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Well, thanks a lot. You know, before you all get out of there, you could tell us your recommendations for somebody who wants to start to understand this field where would you turn them? To a three-unit course at San Francisco State or to a book that you can rely on? How do you get into this? How could you break somebody in if he or she asked for it?
And before you answer, that would also open the door to any other source of the information that that George is looking for. It might be it might be on the web as well, any place that you could point him.
Well, one plug I guess I could say is the Gibson Dunn has a artificial intelligence page on its website where we have lots of different case alerts and things that you could certainly do, and that's a plug there for us. But no, I think there are a lot of really good books out there. Master Machine. There's a number of various books like that that really touch this subject. There's so much out there. I think just even a quick Google search, you'll find a lot of really easy to access issues about some of these things. There's a professor in Washington State, Ryan Kahlo, who writes a lot on robots and AI that I've read a number of good books and articles from him. Those are just some things that come to mind, but there are quite a lot of materials on this.
Yeah, my recommendation really depends on what area you're interested in. I mean, if you're interested in autonomous driving, you can find things on that, or it's financial technologies for healthcare, So I'd really look into those. It's AI so specific to all these subsectors. It's kind of like here in Silicon Valley. I don't think anyone usually uses the word high technology all the time, but they use it all the time, high tech, or even technology. People now talk about very specific sectors, and I think that's true of artificial intelligence. You've got to look at the really specialized area of what you're really interested in.
We're rapidly running out of time tonight, and I wanted to give each of you about 4 minutes or thereabouts for any closing thoughts, any suggestions you had for people, anything you wanted to bring out that we didn't get to tonight. Craig, Mark, who would like to start?
Craig, you want to start?
Yeah, I'll start. I mean, obviously, being in Silicon Valley, artificial intelligence is a huge area, and it's really vital, I think, to the economy and creates great economic benefits. You know, I saw a recent study that showed the economic benefits as far as increasing productivity was approximately 40% over the next 10 years. So I think artificial intelligence is really vital. But however, just like anything, I think it needs to have a check and balance. And as we know, there's a lot of mistakes that are made in artificial intelligence. So we have a long way to go. But I think, as humans, we're going to be really subject to keeping tabs and monitoring and making sure it's done right. Whether that's done on the legal side or ethical side or even a human personal level as well.
And I would echo that. I think that's actually exactly right. There is a lot of good that it's doing right now. I mean, I think the thing that people may not realize is artificial intelligence systems are prolific out there already and are in just about everything you do, from Netflix recommendations to the types of therapies that you may be getting through hospitals. And they do a tremendous job at certain tasks. And we'll be seeing more and more of them in things like autonomous taxis and things like that as time goes on. But regulation is probably very important here to make sure that things are going. I think the one caution is we have to be a little careful about getting out over our skis on regulation, because we don't really know exactly where some of these things are going. It's difficult to regulate ahead of what this technology is doing because it's evolving so quickly. There does need to be regulation. There does need to be standardization. And I think that probably will come, but we have to be a little careful as to not overregulate and put such a damper on it that we actually inhibit our ability to create some of these really fine things.
We did have a call that might be of interest to George from San Francisco. George, I don't know if you're still listening, but a caller called and referred you to a place called Citrus in Berkeley. That's CITRIS in Berkeley, with great information on the layperson. He wanted to make that available to you. We are a little earlier than I had planned, and one thing I'm getting from both of you is just as the technology is growing rather rapidly, it also seems that the regulatory environment is adapting and growing to the changing technologies involved in artificial intelligence. And it seems that to a certain extent, practicing in this field is somewhat akin to the Wild West. Would you say that that's true? That is evolving every day, and it starts out as kind of guesswork and pushing it through to what it should be?
Very much. I mean, one of the most common question I get from clients is, what are the best practices in area X, whatever it might be? And it's a difficult question, because right now it's hard to say what best practices really are. It's evolving so quickly. And so I think, you know, and regulations are there. We have some that don't quite fit sometimes. And so how do you deal with regulations that don't fit with what you're trying to do? And are you allowed to even do certain things? Those are common questions with it all. So I think it's a really fun time to be practicing in law when it comes to this technology. And so it'll just keep going that way for a while until we start to get a better handle on how to deal with this new technologies.
That's right. I mean, it's often, and always is the case, technology is way above everyone else. So, and it's happening everywhere. We don't even know where it's happening because it's all around us. So obviously we want to have those legal protections that need to be careful and be done right, and brings in a lot of, you know, ethical issues as well.
Right. And before I forget, for George too, I thought of one other book that I think is really quite good. It's I'll put a plug in for it. It's Max Tegmark wrote a book called Life 3.0, which is actually a very interesting kind of overview of a lot of these same issues. And that's a good one to read.
You know, one of the things that came up, and I'm going to throw this at you, Josh, because you and I don't practice in this field. You do mostly civil. I do almost all criminal. And yet some of the things we've talked about tonight are creeping into my practice. We had one caller that sent me a message to read on the air asking about automated vehicles or automated machinery that might pick up information and whether that can be used. And things of that type are creeping into our daily lives, and hence they're creeping into the facts involved in my practice as well. From your perspective, have you experienced similar yet, where some of these things are hitting you?
I have not had, to the best of my knowledge, as I sit here, this come into my practice. I would be scared of a judge who allowed propensity to act based on artificial intelligence into the trial. I would think that raises a host of constitutional issues, and that's something that absolutely is going to have to go to the Court of Appeal to be teased out, if not to the Supreme Court. But it'll be interesting when it does, and I can see where it's going to come up at some point. I would think also there's a trade secret issue that if anyone raises any of this, I want every bit of what that artificial intelligence is based on, and they're going to say it's a trade secret, but you have to hand that over for the world to see in order to see whether it's biased. So I could see also there's going to be a lot of trade secret arguments here.
And what I'm walking away from my experience and from hearing you, is that we're really not talking about a great change about what propensity evidence, and that means this is the guy that's likely to do these things, whether that evidence is allowed in or not, hasn't really changed all that much. The rules that allow it sometimes and very seldom and under limited circumstances probably remain the same. The real question that you're bringing up is whether, if we can't use it, at some point are we allowing these programs to consider it? And how's that built into the system? And that's where it starts getting complicated. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 in San Francisco. Tonight, we've been looking at emerging technologies, in particular artificial intelligence. Our guests tonight have been Craig Lilly from Reed Smith LLP and Mark Lyon, chair of the Artificial Intelligence and Automated Systems Practice Group at Gibson Dunn. Our show tonight's been produced by Josh Borger and yours truly. Our Legal Rights returns next week at our new time of 6 o'clock, as we're here to give you last-minute year-end tax advice. What do you need to do before 2020 draws to a close, which can't be soon enough? Once again, thank you, Mark Lyon and Craig Lilly, and especially thanks to all of you for joining us. For Josh Borger and at the controls, Debbie Kennedy, I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night and stay safe.
Support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.